Hello, I'm Kieran Lindsay.
I'm Dan Marcucci, and this is Wired Ivy. We have a combined 18 years of experience in the virtual classroom.
Dan lives in Pennsylvania, I live in Missouri, and we work for a university in Virginia. We know from personal experience that online faculty and staff benefit from having access to their peers.
You may have been teaching online for a long time now, or relatively new to it. You may have been thinking about a move to online, or suddenly find yourself doing it. Regardless, you are all welcome in this virtual salon.
Our goal is to create a collegial community for real academics working in virtual classrooms. A safe, supportive space where we can learn from one another and share what we figured out. Thanks to a year in which online instruction became the unexpected but necessary standard practice in higher ed, our community's assumptions about what subjects can be taught without a physical classroom underwent a profound evolution. Even Dan and I were surprised to discover fellow academics teaching subjects as diverse and seemingly ill-suited to the virtual classroom as ag education, biology lab, sculpture, and urban planning, in most of these cases long before a global pandemic forced the issue for so many. What has also been surprising are the subjects that appear, at first glance, to have a natural affinity for online instruction. For example, one would have to assume that if ever there were academic subjects and student audiences aligned with at least a flipped classroom approach to teaching, that list would have to include mathematics and computer science. After all, math and computer science provide the infrastructure that make virtual classrooms feasible. And yet, as we learned during a lively conversation with colleagues who teach in these disciplines, the pivot hasn't always led to a slam dunk. We want to learn from you, too. What hurdles have you overcome when transitioning in-person courses to the virtual classroom? Share your online teaching story with us by leaving a voice message at speakpipe.com/wiredivy or by sending an email to wiredivypodcast@gmail.com.
We're excited to have two guests today on Wired Ivy. They have mathematics and computer science expertise and long experience teaching both undergraduate and graduate learners. Ganesh Erchal is an associate professor in the Department of Computer Science at Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. Her teaching encompasses discrete mathematics, bioinformatics, theory of computation, and algorithms. Ganesh's research interests include graph theory and its applications. Ganesh, we're so glad to have you on Wired Ivy today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Stacy Levine is professor of mathematics and the chair of the Department of Mathematics and Computer Science in the McNulty College and the Graduate School of Liberal Arts at Duquesne University. Among other topics, she teaches linear algebra and differential equations, as well as digital image processing and optimization. Stacy's research centers on the mathematical method for image processing. Stacy, welcome to Wired Ivy.
Nice to be here. Thanks, Dan.
It's nice to meet you both.
So Kieran and I don't really need introductions for the Wired Ivy audience, but I do want to sort of warn you both that several careers ago, Kieran was a computer programmer. So she knows a few things about computers that you guys can all have a conversation probably in a level that I can't. Although that said, I feel a little bit like a hostess at a Virginia Woolf dinner party because I know all of you and I've invited you to this table, as it were. And you guys are just getting to meet each other for the first time. So I'll try not to spill the soup and we'll see how it goes from there. Kieran, why don't you go ahead and start with some of the initial questions?
Sure. I like to start out by hearing people's origin stories. So Ganesh, let's start with you. How long have you been teaching? How did you end up in academia? Tell us a little bit about your involvement with the teaching side of computer science and your subject matter.
I taught as a teaching assistant at UCLA my second year of PhD in 2002. Then from spring 2003 and the next 3.5 years or so, I was continuously TA for theory of computation there. I was always more interested in theoretical topics. It didn't even occur to me to just go into industry right after my undergraduate degree. So it just didn't really occur to me to do anything else. I liked teaching. I'm not going to say that I was completely natural at it or that I loved it by the end of my PhD, because I wouldn't say that I even liked public speaking.
Can you tell me a little bit about what your course load is? And are you teaching undergrads, graduate, some combination of that? How many students are in the classes that you teach? Give me a little overview of that, if you wouldn't mind.
It's been affected by the pandemic, obviously. I had been teaching discrete math in the falls for some time. Our course load in the School of Engineering at SIUE is generally 5 courses per year,
okay,
which is like 3-2 or 2-3, right?
Mm-hmm.
Usually for me, that would include discrete mathematics, which was in the fall for computer science students. And then I would have either bioinformatics or theory of computation or both, and also CS340, which is our data structures and algorithms class. Discrete mathematics, last time I taught, if I had let everybody who wanted to be in, it would probably be up to 80 students, but it was probably like 65 or so.
Mm-hmm.
Undergraduate required class of data structures and algorithms. When I checked exactly a year ago, spring 2020 enrollment, it was like approximately 30 to 35 each section, and there were 2 sections. Prior to the pandemic, like bioinformatics students, they're not intimidated, but they didn't know how much biology background they needed to go into it. And so they were not as attracted and a little bit fearful.
Mm-hmm.
And so that would usually have like between 15 and 20. Sometimes it would be like 12 to 18. The pandemic had an interesting effect on that particular class, I will say. And then theory of computation, I would usually have from anywhere from 15 to 25.
And I'll just say, as somebody who has been in both the mathematics, computer science side of things and the biology side of things, biology is scarier. It's a lot harder to predict, right? Stacy, can you also give us a little bit of your background, how long you've been teaching, how you ended up in academia, what kind of courses you're teaching, that kind of thing?
Sure. I kind of followed my nose and fell into academia. So when I was an undergrad, I tutored while I was on campus, and I actually loved it. It kind of is right up my alley, and was friends with all my tutors because we were all majors together. And I discovered the summer between my junior and senior year, you could apply to graduate school. They would pay you to be a TA and pay for graduate school, and you didn't have to apply for a job. And that sounded like a fabulous path forward for somebody who liked math and liked teaching. And so I said, sure, I'll just go with that. So I applied and got into a PhD program, not necessarily the usual path, maybe, but it did work out. And I did really enjoy teaching as a grad student. By my second semester, they were giving me my own classes. So I got to really do a lot of fun things. I was at University of Florida, teach some, you know, several hundred people lecture halls, which I enjoyed. I taught smaller classes. I had a mix of things. I taught classes in different formats. And yeah, and I've been at Duquesne for 20 years now.
Okay. You mentioned that you have not ever taught online prior to the pandemic. Is that correct?
Prior to March 17th of 2020, something around there.
Had you ever taken an online course yourself?
Nope.
Ganesh, how about you? Had you ever taught anything online before?
I had not.
And had you ever taken anything?
No, I had not.
I want to go back, I guess, to March 17th of last year or March 10th or whenever. Pretty much everyone I've spoken to has happened over their spring break and they had basically no notice. So it's been a year since we've had in higher education this sudden pivot to emergency remote learning. You have both said really no prior training in the area and it just had to happen all of a sudden. I think you've even mentioned a little bit how you satisfied the spring courses. The sort of 10,000 foot question is, so how was it? Was it fun? What was your initial response to having to make that pivot? Why don't we start with you, Stacy, and then hear from Ganesh?
I was only teaching one course because I'm department chair and I have a grant and research. And so a bunch of things going on. I had my one class of 30 students, but I found because I'm department chair, I was mainly focused on the fact in mathematics and computer science, particularly in mathematics, we have so many sections. We have our tenure track faculty, non-tenure track faculty, adjuncts, graduate students, so many people that I was mostly concerned making sure everybody had the resources they needed to pivot to online. And then I panicked and realized I had to prepare my own class because I didn't know what I was doing. So as everyone was getting settled, we had our spring break, came back from spring break, and then found out Wednesday when we got back, we were going to have 2 days off, I think Thursday and Friday, and then the following Monday we were going online. So I think I had about 24 hours and I spent a lot of time figuring out how to write with Notability and so I could just give my lectures and just was thrown into it.
Had you been using your LMS, whether it was, I don't know, Canvas or Blackboard, I don't know what you use at Duquesne. Had you been using it already in your courses? Was your material up there already?
Yeah. Yes. So I've used Blackboard for years. That's what we use. And most of us did. Not everyone in the department was using Blackboard, but most of us were. So yes, a lot of materials were up there, but I didn't have pre-prepared lecture notes. I used my 85 board around the room, and that was certainly quite a challenge.
And then what I'm hearing is that the class that you were teaching, you continue to teach synchronously for the rest of the semester?
Yep, synchronously.
How about you, Ganesh? How did it feel last March? Was it fun?
As you know, I have a 5-year-old, and I know other people also have small kids, and my house is not that big, okay? Not at all. The issue of getting back into teaching online, it took me at least a couple of weeks from the time that we learned that we were going to do that. There's also the issue, did I want to teach online? For one whole year, you know, I had worked on proposing my bioinformatics class to be on an online class, a new online elective. So I was actually wanting to do online previously. And it goes through this, you know, bureaucratic process and discussions in the department and stuff for everything, you know, every change of format that we are making. We have the departmental approval, and then it goes through this multiple levels of approval. So I was a little bit annoyed, and I have no right to be, because of course there was a pandemic, but I had already, you know, for a while, like, been waiting on the approval of this thing to be online. And then all of a sudden I have to put all of my courses online at once. Like, normally this is like a very big preparation to prepare an online course. And all of a sudden we're all put into this together for all of our courses in the middle of the term, right? I had 3 classes at that time, 2 sections of algorithms, and then 1 theory of computation. And I was more than halfway through, actually in the algorithms class. I had gotten quite far along in their required subject matter for their projects and assignments. And they were going to have a lot of like group activities after that. Mm-hmm. So I felt I had a lot of flexibility in that class, which had the most students. Mm-hmm. And they're undergraduates. They're emailing me and they're telling me how they have connection problems. We have some students who live, you know, in very rural Illinois areas. There's other students who live near East St. Louis, others in Chicago, and they're all dealing with their own stuff. So thank goodness I had the flexibility. We had already covered a lot of the subject matter. I could do like review-ish things. All of mine, by the way, were asynchronous. There was no way that with my 4-year-old, I was going to be able to do synchronous classes. I'm sorry. You know, even the way I did it asynchronously, there would be multiple rounds of having to redo videos. But it was a good exercise. I liked it, actually. Eventually, though, it was good. And it was interesting, you know, making a lot of these activities online. It was a very big time effort, but it was definitely worthwhile by the end.
You've sort of alluded to some of the students' responses. I'm wondering what they said to you as far as if they liked being online, above and beyond the sort of connection and technical issues. And also if they kind of felt as connected, you know, with the course or with the program or with school. I mean, did they say anything to you about that?
So in the fall term, I had 40 students. So I had a full load on theory of computation. They would never have more than 25 because of the rooms, but it would never like fill to 25. And then all of a sudden it's 40. Now there could be multiple reasons for that.
Growing larger than the rooms would have allowed them otherwise.
Right. Given that it was asynchronous, I allow them, as long as they give me 24 hours in advance notice, they can do office hours with me by appointment. I also would do review sessions before their quiz tests. On the CS340, I did have some positive feedback. In fact,
since one of you taught asynchronously and the other taught synchronously, I'm curious, where are your students usually based? Ganesh, you chose asynchronous because it worked for you. Generally speaking, it works pretty well for students too, although some of them miss that accountability of having to log in at a particular time. For synchronous, if the students are based further afield, the whole issue of when the course is taught can be an issue. Stacy, since you taught synchronously, can you speak to that? And then I'll come back to Ganesh and get her thoughts on how that played out with her specific students.
We do offer some online courses in our department. I've watched people prepare them. And as Ganesh was saying, and you all know, it's a long process to put together a really well done asynchronous class, right? To keep the students engaged when you're not physically engaged at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Can't just walk into the room and give a lecture off the cuff.
No.
And also it's recorded. So if you do.
Exactly. You know, several of our faculty who had taught online when we made the transition mention, were taking all of their courses and creating perfect online versions, which petrified me. I'm like, I knew I did not have the time to put together these well-done lecture snippets that would go well. I had no idea how to do that, and I didn't have the training. So part of the reason for staying synchronous was that, number one, is I didn't have the training and didn't know how to do it well. The second thing is that our students started synchronously. And I think a lot of them, because of how they started, they didn't register for online courses. Some of them did fine with some of the asynchronous instruction and found out, oh, maybe I like this better than I thought. But there were a lot of students that were so overwhelmed and petrified that all of a sudden they had to go home. Their lives were turned upside down. Turned out after a few synchronous sessions, it seemed to work. And a lot of them, when they would pop on for office hours, they would say, I'm really glad we have these sessions, because it just gave them a sense of normalcy in their life. Mm-hmm. Even though they're working from their high school bedroom, it was normal. I think that made a big difference in why the synchronous worked really well.
Of course, Duquesne is a private Catholic university in Pittsburgh, but I get the sense that most of your students are within a couple of time zones of Pittsburgh.
Yes.
You weren't dealing with people in Korea or anything, were you?
No. And that was a big benefit. Now, we do have small master's programs. Some of our students in the master's program do come from Asia and other places. Some tried to go home right away. That caused some issues, but the master's, that was very targeted, so we could handle the master's students in a different way if need be. Now, in my class, I didn't have any issues with this, but there were other faculty members who had students that had bad internet connections. I did have one student that had trouble on and off, but a lot of them are from the Pennsylvania area or within a few time zones.
Right, right. Ganesh, how did the asynchronous work for the students in your program? We know that it was a no-brainer for you as the instructor.
Or no option?
Well, initially, yeah, it was no option. And then I continued in the fall. One of the classes I had, like I said, the bioinformatics, I had already proposed that and it was approved prior to the pandemic, right? Now, I will say there is a difference between teaching like an intro class to freshmen or sophomores and a senior slash graduate elective. Mm-hmm. And secondly, I even think there's a difference between computer science and mathematics. I don't know, like if I taught discrete mathematics, I don't think I could have done that asynchronously. Mm-hmm. That's like a freshman slash sophomore class. My friends who do teach discrete mathematics elsewhere, they have, let's say, hundreds of students, multiple sections, and their breakout rooms are insane. Mm-hmm. It will be both a combination of asynchronous prior made videos and then synchronous kind of group activities. It's also differences in what the students are accustomed to.
People can see the value of having the flexibility of asynchronous. Where they get hung up on it is that if they don't lock it into their schedule and treat it as if it were being taught at that point and stick to it, it gets postponed and postponed.
That is absolutely correct. And I just want to say, like, in terms of feedback from students, I had a very lovely feedback from a student. He said he loves the asynchronous. He likes it that he can go back and rewatch parts that he gets stuck on. Mm-hmm.
And that makes sense when you think about it. If an instructor is really on a roll, often the students are just stenographers, trying to write down every word, hoping their notes will be close enough to what was said that they'll make sense when there's time to read them and think about it. We can get around that issue completely by having something pre-recorded, because then students can listen for comprehension, knowing they can go back as often as necessary. They can still take notes, and probably should, since writing things down can help to secure the ideas in our memory. But the ephemeral nature of a live lecture is, to my mind, one of the negative aspects of that traditional approach.
It has to be done really well, and you have to know what you're doing. Having these little snippets of lectures are really nice, where you can have examples. And so I do know there were several faculty who did create these lovely online asynchronous courses for their students. And some of the students really like those snippets, right? Because they could rewatch them over and over. But again, it's that level of self-discipline that does become the challenge.
Yeah. I do want to follow up on one thing about synchronous. Did you record them as you were having the classes? You're nodding, and that's best practices, right? We don't want people to think that just because the course is taught synchronously, students don't still have access to that video to go back over it again. One of the things that has come out of online instruction is that, well, one, you have to record it anyway, because you never know if somebody's going to lose their internet connection. Often it's that live stream recording that helps instructors to see the value of pre-recording content. Seeing and hearing yourself leads directly to the desire to polish your presentation through retakes, better lighting, and editing. So the final file is closer to how we envision ourselves as educators and speakers. Once the lecture is recorded, the natural next question is, what do I do with my synchronous teaching time now? It's a progression from backup recording to intentional video production to using live time for something more interactive.
When I was a graduate student, the way they trained us is they videoed us proving the Pythagorean theorem. And it was the worst thing in the world to watch myself do this. I was 21 years old and it was terrible. So I have purposely not watched any of my videos, which is terrible. I'm admitting that, but I am petrified. At least the feedback, I haven't heard that they're terrible. So I'm hiding.
Early on when I was teaching, I thought it was important to just be off the cuff. And this was early on. So the technology was a little different. And so I wasn't using a script because I thought, no, it seems more natural if I'm just kind of off the cuff. And then at the end, when I got the reviews back, I had a number of students talk to me about how annoying it was to hear me go, yeah. And that was the end. My off the cuff. I at least had talking points from that point on, because exactly the experience that you're talking about right there, which is I had no idea. I was kind of outraged. Come on, that's pretty nitpicky. That's a problem you have with this course, is that I say every now and then. But I took a breath, I listened back to it, and I went, damn it, they really have a point there. I'm certainly finding it annoying.
I was initially kind of the thing that actually that delayed my going online, I'm self-conscious, right? I don't like seeing myself in the corner. Was I going to be distracted by that thumbnail or whatever? And then of course, how I'm speaking, and then later, am I going to edit it, et cetera, et cetera. Now I'm just noticing, right? Kieran, Stacy, me, we're women also. I wonder if that increases our self-consciousness about that, like how others view us. In the teaching evaluations, students may make more comments about how women speak and their appearance, perhaps, than their male counterparts.
We're trained from birth.
Yeah. So are we sufficiently pleasant, right?
You should smile more.
Yeah.
Maybe our episode title will be The Pleasant Mathematicians. We can do that, right?
Oh, yes.
Stacy and Ganesh, do you have questions of each other or anything of us that, you know, you've thought of so far?
I don't know. It sounds like most of you all teach asynchronously. But one of the biggest challenges with the synchronous instruction, we're teaching hybrid right now. So I have to teach synchronously because I have students physically in the classroom while I'm teaching remotely.
So when you say hybrid, you mean some students physically present in the class and some attending virtually. You're nodding. So yes, what you're talking about is the hardest thing.
Yes, it's the worst of all worlds for an instructor.
And for the students too. Because it's just natural for the instructor to focus on the people in the classroom. No matter where she is in the room, the students are in her visual field. But if she steps away from the computer, the virtual students disappear, especially if they've been muted. If there's no moderator keeping an eye on the virtual students, it doesn't matter that they've raised their hand because the instructor doesn't see them, or she sees the question long after the class has moved on to a new subject. This happened to me once in a faculty training on, believe it or not, best practices for online instruction. The class was a mix of in-person and virtual attendees. The speaker stepped away from the podium, started taking questions from people in the room. Then, as the presentation was winding down, she came back to the podium, saw her screen, and said, "Oh, I see we had some questions on Zoom. Sorry about that. We're running out of time, though, so just email me and I'll answer there." If that speaker looked at the chat thread later, she also saw a running commentary from the Zoom folks about how best practices should include not ignoring your virtual attendees.
You know, for smaller classes, it works better because you can see the students, you know, you can see the mix a bit better. It gets more, the larger the class gets, the more challenging. I'm grateful we have this as an option because we do have students who want to be in the classroom. So we're able to serve both communities, but it's so challenging. It's not as challenging as we thought it would be. At first, we had no idea if it would work at all. And it does work. There are certain things that, although we had this issue with online, is we found group work was very challenging because breakout rooms, it's one thing, I think it's different when it's discussion in a breakout room. It's another thing where I have my students do group work all the time. I'll give them an example and I'll give them a little challenging problem and say, get together and discuss. If I'm in the room, I can monitor them all simultaneously. But if I have to go from breakout room to breakout room to breakout room, by the time I'm in my third or fourth room, I go in and some of them have been sitting there staring at each other because no one knew how to start. But I would know that if we were all physically in the same space. So mm-hmm. We've had challenges with breakout rooms. It's very challenging because the students don't want to put their cameras on, which makes it really hard to get to know your students in the same way that those who do put their cameras on or that are in the classroom.
Right. There definitely is a difference between doing group work in person or online, synchronously or asynchronously. But again, it depends on the audience. Some are better prepared to do one format or another, or better suited to do one format over another. We've definitely heard about breakout room issues from other guests, such as the instructor pops in and discovers the students are all talking about what they're going to do this weekend rather than the problem they were assigned.
Stacy, although you didn't use the exact words, I think you mentioned something like a flipped classroom, so the students were able to listen to the lectures on their own time. It strikes me that mathematics and computer science kind of lend themselves to that flipped approach, where they're going to listen to lectures, absorb the resources, then come back to the group work or to class to do the problem solving and other hands-on real-time work. Is that something you've intentionally tried to leverage?
You know, I teach a course as a flipped classroom, just in the usual non-pandemic, just in the classroom, because there are some video lectures that were already prepared that were really quite nice. And I have these problem sets where they're supposed to watch the lecture and then do these kind of pre-problems. So they're ready to come into class to discuss. Some of the faculty members have done more flipped classroom, even last spring and then this year. What's interesting is that the students who watch the videos say they're fabulous. But if you're a math or computer science, you can read the book and figure out from examples. That's a lot quicker than watching someone else explain it. So that's what you do, is you follow the examples. And depending on the level of class you're in, especially in the lower level classes where it's more computational, you follow the examples, you figure it out. And if you're able to solve the problems you're given, you're done. You don't need to listen to a lecture. You don't need to read. You don't need to do anything else. So they only use these lectures when they really need to. They typically approach it, let me go to the problem set, see what I can figure out. I can't figure it out. Is there an example I can mimic? Mm-hmm. If they're really stuck, then they go back to the lecture snippets. So we spend all this time preparing these lovely things that don't get so much traction. Typically, it's towards the end of the semester that the student who's barely passing, that you're like, please watch the snippets. And they watch it and they're like, those were great. And like, I should have done that from the beginning of the semester. And
yeah. Ganesh, is that something that you've seen?
Well, so I had never done flipped classroom prior to the pandemic. I mean, of course, I enjoy the energy of being in a classroom. You know, if I love some topic, like I do like describing it on the board. I didn't know how nice it was going to be that I can zoom in and out here. And then it's basically an enormous whiteboard part. And so I really liked it towards the end, but I actually had a resistance even to using that technology initially. Some folks will use it, you know, during class, actually, like even in biology, they were using their iPad. I do like whiteboard, like the physical whiteboard. I do like, you know, going up and drawing lots of pictures and explaining and stuff. But I had not, prior to the pandemic, made those videos. In the future, I think I would, though, now that I went through this. And now that also some topics are common across different classes.
Well, and there's existing content out there for a lot of things that can be repurposed so that you can focus your attention on the specifics of what you want to do with your class or what you want to do with your students, instead of spending your time producing a video that takes somebody through a process. We use TED Talks often. Why wouldn't you? You know, you've got a world expert on something. It's wonderfully produced and it adds another voice to the class. But we're teaching a different subject than mathematics.
Yeah. Honestly, this is going to sound maybe very weird and strange, especially for a computer scientist, but I cannot stand through another person's lecture on my topic. I don't know why. This is terrible. But like, I will, you know, listen in the beginning and then I'll either get bored or like, I think because I teach so much also building upon examples, I know there's excellent material, nicely made, smooth, etc. But it's difficult for me myself to sit through another person.
Well, you know, that's really interesting. And I was thinking about this as you were describing how you like to get up and move around. So many colleagues have said they miss being able to move around instead of sitting at a desk tied to a computer screen. And yet, how often do instructors turn that inclination around and ask if students would prefer to be more active, not just sitting passively listening and taking notes? Isn't it funny how we assume, through acculturation and our own experiences, that certain activities and behaviors belong with certain roles? Do we really think that teaching is a physically dynamic activity, but learners need to sit still so they can absorb what we're saying, like a sponge? There's certainly research to suggest other learning modalities are more effective, at least for some students.
That's true. That's such a good point, because especially, I mean, certainly in mathematics, lectures go so much more nicely when the students can do group work.
Right.
When you can do some lecture and then let them just dig into it and talk, and then you can move around the room, and because then they're having just a different level of interaction, it breaks it up. So that's been one thing that's been so difficult, is when you have a synchronous lecture, is not being able to do that.
Yeah. Because as you just explained, Stacey, the natural tendency for many of these students is to take an active approach to the content, as in, give me the problem set and let me see what I can do. If I need help, I'll access a recorded lecture or ask for assistance strategically. I wonder if moving so many of these courses into a virtual space will result in greater adoption of a flipped approach to teaching these subjects, to make the best use of face-to-face time for that active engagement. The recorded lectures prime the pump, so to speak, for in-person class meetings that function as collaborative working spaces.
As you're speaking, Kieran, it just made me think about, it really focuses on the problem sets. You have to be so thoughtful about what your assignments are, because if we're really thinking that's a way of teaching, and it does go backwards like this, is here's exactly what I want you to learn. And if you can do all of this, then you're great. So whatever means, you can fill in that knowledge, whether it be the book and you don't need me at all because the book was great.
Yeah.
Right? You figure out the problems. But if you do that, then you miss the whole story. And really, how important is that whole story? In mathematics, it is a whole story. You know, you start from the beginning, you're building up a theory. Even in linear algebra, you're building up these concepts one on the other. So is it sufficient enough to learn the snippets to solve the problems, or do they have to hear that whole story? Or maybe, I don't know, it's a question.
That was my problem as I got into higher mathematics. For a long time, I got by with what I called light bulb moments, where I would have a leap of understanding from step 5 to step 10 in a 10-step problem. I loved those moments because I could finish my problem sets quickly, but the joke was on me because later I did have to go back and review to get those last 5 steps when I realized, oh yeah, I actually do need them to understand how to solve more difficult problems.
I've taken a lot of math because I had an engineering degree, but even in the courses that I'm teaching now, some of the issues are the same, which is that you really got to be very intentional about how you structure a lesson. You've got to be very clear about what your learning objectives are going to be. And then you have to have a series of activities, and whether you set it up so that they go through these activities sequentially or in parallel, or they work in groups. The point is that has to all be done before the lesson gets published.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of something that's important about online learning, is you've really got to put a lot of energy into designing the lesson and, you know, presumably designing the course as well. You know, the examples that you want to give are kind of analogous to the case studies that I use. I'm very proud of my case studies. I'm with you, Ganesh, on that one. It's like, no, that's an interesting way of explaining it, but I think I've got a better case study, you know, that kind of thing. But the intentionality and the work that goes into online from the instructor's perspective, it kind of really restructures our workload, I find.
And, you know, this is going to surprise people who have not taught online, although that's a smaller minority now.
It's almost nobody now.
Right. But the issue that comes to mind for me is that the education field considers the physical classroom the default, how things are supposed to be. And yet the ephemeral nature of that real-time delivery, that live performance, leaves a lot of questions unanswered. Does it actually work? Does it work equally well or poorly for all students? In some ways, grades are the only available metric for that analysis, but are they the only relevant metric? By contrast, the online environment provides a wealth of data on each individual student, at least potentially. As we've discussed before, you can see exactly who participated in a discussion. You can see which students watched a pre-recorded video, whether they watched to the end, whether they watched some sections more than once. The instructor can see patterns in class engagement and performance. Even in a synchronously delivered course, there should be a recording of the video conference. That has the potential to hold online instruction to another standard than classroom instruction. I won't say it's a higher standard, but it is a different standard because it can be reviewed. When you lecture in a classroom, you can walk back to your office thinking, wow, I hit that one out of the park.
And no one can prove otherwise.
I mean, you might ask the students and they might differ. But as long as you don't ask for any input, you're golden, right? You can keep moving along with that idea.
Yeah.
I don't think it's more work. I think it's front-loaded work. But I don't know. I might be changing my mind about that.
It might be more work too, but it's definitely front-loaded.
Yeah. Yeah.
I do want to say at least one thing regarding the front loaded. So the pandemic obviously changed some of that for many of us who were not online previously. So my videos are not so polished. You know, I should probably divide it up. Some of them are long, but I would have at least hundreds of tiny snippets.
And they can't hit pause.
Yeah.
That's one thing that they can't do in the real-time lecture, synchronous or in the classroom, right? It's like, if you need a minute, you can't hit pause, right?
Exactly.
It makes me wonder, now that you both had this experience of teaching online, and you're talking a little bit, Ganesh, about how you'll handle the bioinformatics course in new iterations. Do you think this experience of having taught online is going to then reflect back on all of your teaching? I mean, for the courses that eventually we will go back to, you know, something that's in person, do you think it's changing the way you'll approach teaching?
100% for me.
Well, I guess the follow-up question will be, how?
Well, the flipped, right? Like, so even like in discrete mathematics, where I have to do, I feel a lot of review each subsequent class, like I'm reviewing partly the previous class, and still in a room of 60 something students, I still, you know, just because of the fundamental subject matter, no matter how, in my opinion, interestingly and enthusiastically I'm teaching, they still, part of them are still just not catching it. I think I will have to incorporate pre-produced video lectures. So our department's attitude towards online changed. They're more open towards it now, but more for the graduate things, you know, I think a lot of them will be hybrid, partly online at least.
So we haven't really put Stacy on the spot yet about if she is going to do anything different going forward. So has this online experience and you know, your teaching load is a little bit lighter because you are chair right now. So you can live vicariously and talk about your faculty and your department too, if you want to. Do you see this changing the way classes are taught that, you know, are campus-based?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there will still be room for in the classroom. And then I think that having this kind of this asynchronous activity and all the mix that active learning, it's got to be part of what's in the classroom. But I think we'll be more mindful of our students' time when they're in the classroom. Honestly, the fact that we do have these electronic communication, so even synchronous, the fact that I can do Zoom office hours, my student doesn't have to say, I can't make it to your office hours because my job goes until 3 and I can't make it to campus. So easy to just hop onto Zoom and share a whiteboard. I also have the option, if I go to a conference, I don't have to find a substitute, or I can record lectures. I can even do a synchronous Zoom lecture if that's what my students are used to. I can do that from Italy or who knows wherever I might be. Yes, I think there's a lot of things that are wonderful from it, things that will be challenging from it.
There's never going to be a one size fits all. There just never is. But that's okay. That doesn't mean that we can't improve each individual offering and do a better job. We've been doing that all along. This is just the next iteration of how we go about that.
You know, now that we're warmed up, we could go another 2 hours. I can tell that it's not that we've run out of topics.
I know. I have questions for Ganesh now.
This is fantastic. Stacy Levine from Duquesne University in Pittsburgh. Ganesh Earnshaw from Southern Illinois University, Edwardsville. This has just been a wonderful conversation. We got to do it again soon.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely. Thank you so much.
Pleasure. We've enjoyed it.
Really generous of both of you to spend this time with us.
Now we want to hear what you have to say. Send us your questions, comments, and suggestions. You can record a voice message, send an email, or leave a comment on our website, wiredivy.org. And help Wired Ivy grow by sharing, subscribing, rating, and reviewing us on your favorite podcast app.
Wired Ivy is wholly owned by Kieran Lindsay and Dan Marcucci, and we are solely responsible for its content. Views expressed in this podcast and affiliated media are those of Kieran, Dan, and our guests, and do not represent Virginia Tech or any other institution.
Our audio engineer is Starpath Images, and a license for our theme music, Breakfast With You, was purchased from Smart Sound.
Until next time, this is Dan Marcucci.
And I'm Kieran Lindsay. Let's stay connected.